You should see in your upper left corner, you should see a time ticker, just so you know. Okay. Is there anything that you do not want me to ask about?
No, go ahead.
No? Okay. I try to give that courtesy to make sure that...
That's nice. That actually is very nice, but...
Okay. Okay. Today on the Intellectual People podcast, I have Mike from... let me start over here. Hold on.
Gotcha.
Sorry about that. Today on the Intellectual People podcast, I have Mike from Captains for Clean Water. How you doing, Mike?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. If you would explain what Captains for Clean Water actually is for those listening.
So we're an advocacy group that fights for Everglades restoration. In Florida, we have some major water issues, really that stem from the historic water flow being diverted. Lake Okeechobee used to overfill and flow south, creating sort of a river, which was known as a river of grass, about 60 miles wide, very slow moving. As the water would flow through that river, the grass would clean the water and some of it would percolate through the ground and restore our water supplies, move into the aquifer. Some of it would trickle all the way down to Florida Bay, where it would support the saltwater freshwater balance down there.
Okay.
And years ago, they diverted that water to the coasts and created a big, the Everglades agricultural area, a big farm area south of the lake. So that water, very little of the water gets down to the Everglades now. Probably half of that water now gets there.
And why is that important?
Because it maintains that two reasons. One, because it maintains the freshwater saltwater balance. So now the Everglades are hypersaline. So you have Florida Bay, which is the largest contiguous seagrass meadow in the world, which, you know, produces oxygen, absorbs CO2. It's a nursery for all our game fish and basically our oceans. And it's too salty. So, you know, good example I think it was 2017 or 2016, 50,000 acres of seagrass died because it got too salty. Mm. And, you know, all this crystal clear water, now there's no grass to hold the mud or sand down. So now anytime the wind blows, it's dirty. The grass can't take root. You know, we're just losing these big seagrass meadows. The second is because the water that's being diverted to the coast are not being cleansed before that gets to the coast. So it's created all sorts of problems. It's feeding the red tides. It's destroying the seagrass. In the area where I live in Stewart, maybe 10 or 15 miles of seagrasses are gone now, completely gone. So really from Lake Okeechobee south all through South Florida, the diversion of the water has really impacted our waterways and our way of life.
Why was the water diverted? Who and why was that done?
Good, really good question. It was originally done back in the early 1900s. The concept was we have this big swamp. Florida's a sort of a swamp. It's marshy and wet. So let's drain it. And that's what they did. They diverted some of the water that was coming over from Lake Okeechobee. They built canals to direct the water in different areas and push them out towards the coast. And drain the land. And basically they took the upper third of the Everglades because you have this long history, millions of years of water with grass and the grass dying and decaying and going to the bottom, which creates sort of peat, creates this fertilizer. You know, there's a foot and a half thick layer of just the amazing fertilizer. So when they dried it all up, they realized, wow, you know, we could plant anything in the world here and it'll grow. And, you know, given Florida's climate, you just about literally can.
Right.
So the state, you know, decided, okay, this is going to be a really good area that we can create as an agricultural area. And they did it, an Everglades agricultural area. And they built that. So, probably 10% of it or less is really vegetables. Everything else, 90% or more, is sugar cane. Hmm. And now that those farms are there, you know, the water can't go south.
Was it a political move or was it a, I want to build on this land? Like, why?
I think initially it was all done in, you know, with good intentions.
Okay.
I think initially it was like, okay, we can drain this land. We can grow just amazing vegetables and all here. And even when sugarcane first came in, the concept was, okay, you know, we can grow sugar and have cheaper sugar. We won't have to buy it on the, you know, on the world market. We can keep it domestically. So originally that was the plan. And nobody realized the impact it was going to have on the Everglades. And, you know, the Everglades is the second largest national park in this country. And it's kind of a swamp. It's very tropical, very wet. And when it's not very wet, it suffers.
And wildlife dies, right? Safe to say.
Quite often, yeah.
Yeah.
And it, I mean, even just, if you look at old images, even aerials, old aerials of Florida, you'll see that the Everglades were water with grass and very green and lush. Now it's dry. Even the terrain has changed. It's a lot of myrtles, a lot of cattails, you know, things that don't really support life. And the majority, the entire EAA is just sugarcane.
How did Captains for Clean Water come about?
So a couple of fishing guides out of Fort Myers, Florida, Daniel Andrews and Chris Whitman, they were there when Florida Bay started dying off, and they were going to the Everglades on trips all the time and just going down there for fun fishing, and just got so frustrated with it, combined with, you know, the diversion of water over to their coast, to the Fort Myers area, was impacting their fishing as well, and just got fed up with it and said, you know, we got to do something. So they created this advocacy group, having no idea how big they were going to get and how much time it was going to take. It ended up, you know, consuming their jobs. They don't guide anymore. They work full time for Captains, and they work tirelessly. I mean, those guys, 12-hour days is a short day for those guys.
Right.
So they formed the group really to be something different, to be something that can reach out to politicians, to reach out to the people that really make the decisions on where the water goes in this country, and to educate them. And they've done an amazing job of it.
How did they do it?
You know, part of it's social media, okay, which was brilliant. Part of it was enlisting the help of other guides. The real way that they did it differently, a couple ways. One, they're not scientists. And a lot of conservation groups have scientists that speak for them. And once they start talking in scientific terms, they lose the layman. It's very common. And with water issues, it is somewhat of a complicated issue. So you get a good example would be they talk about water that's coming over the spillways right now in cubic feet a second, you know, and they say it's coming over at 1,000 cubic feet a second. Well, that, what does that mean to you? I mean, right, how much is that? You know, that's 1 million gallons of water a day. So it kind of gives you an idea, you know, 1 million gallons of water an hour. Is it, what is that number? So they just started, you know, doing the math and explaining to people what's really happening. So there was a major connection there. And the other side was, as we would have these events, we'd call them, where we'd have red tide blooms, we'd have cyanobacteria algae blooms, we would have, 8, 10, 12 months of fresh water being dumped on our coasts and coastal estuaries that are saltwater now fresh. They just were really good at documenting it, getting out on the water because they're guides, and getting out, filming it, documenting it. You know, when you hear about like a blue-green algae bloom, you don't even, if you don't see it, you don't know. If you don't even live near the water, you don't know.
Right.
But when you go and you see a video of, oh my God, and you look at it and you go, oh, here's a bunch of manatees in the middle of this algae. That's gotta be horrible. How are they even surviving? It's real impactful. So they've been able to do it that way and reach out to the legislators and get meetings with them. And, you know, from there, it's sort of got the public's trust and become authorities on the subjects. And now they're rolling.
And when you say they're rolling, things are happening in terms of changes, correct?
Finally. And that's a really good question as well. You know, we had the comprehensive Everglades restoration plan. It's been around for 23 years, I think, 24 years. It was a plan to build a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee that would clean the water and then send it south and into the Everglades. It was a 20-year plan. 20 years in, nothing happened. Mm. And these guys have been working hard. Captains for Clean Water is 5 years old. They broke ground on the reservoir August, I believe. They broke ground on it. You know, so things have started to happen in the last 2 years. And I mean, more happened in the last 2 years than happened in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
So we're actually starting to see some solutions. And part of that is the problems have gotten so bad. They've exacerbated so bad that, you know, people just can't live with it anymore. When you have miles of dead fish washing up on the beach and hotels and businesses that are just trying to operate and can't because of the conditions, it has an impact and people start screaming. And when it starts impacting the economics of the state, that's when the state really has to listen and politicians have to listen because, you know, their job's not to get voted out.
Right. People might not know, certainly for the people that live in Florida, might know what red tide is, but can you explain what red tide is? I think that's an important thing.
No, red tides. It's actually an organism that is commonly found in the oceans, it's very common in the Gulf of Mexico. It's naturally occurring. It's just an algae. It's a lot of cells that are in the water and they grow really fast, really quickly. And if they're fed, the more nutrients they're fed, the quicker they grow and the larger they grow. But the big problem with red tides is they eat up oxygen. They feed on nitrogen, they eat up oxygen. So they take the oxygen out of the water and we have fish kills. And really any animals that are out there are dying, crabs, everything. And then they feed off of them, you know, as those things break down. So it's just this horrible cycle. And they found that, you know, it's naturally occurring, but since we've had these diverted water issues on the coast, we're getting them in larger quantities, more common. It's almost an annual event now. It didn't used to be. The size of the events are tremendous. They didn't used to be. So they're obviously feeding off of the nutrients that are released with these water diversions. A lot of these nutrients, the water that's coming out has a lot of nitrogen and it has a lot of phosphorus in it, as well as other chemicals. And the red tides are obviously feeding on them. So, you know, now we have just red tide events are pretty common. And I live on the East Coast.
Right.
I've only ever seen them twice, and both times I've ever seen them were when they were, you know, sending big volumes of water to our coast. So they're out there all the time. If you create the environment that, you know, where they can grow and feed, you're going to have growth.
And by changing the water diversion back to what it was before the diversion will help mitigate them?
It will, first off, because it won't, you know, it'll clean the water. So those nutrients won't go out into Florida Bay. It'll be cleaner, considerably cleaner water. Even the reservoir that they have planned, the idea was to originally have it as a shallow reservoir with a lot of plants. And because of size constraints, the original size got decreased.
Okay.
So now they just make it deeper with plants. But, you know, ideally it will clean all the water before it goes into Florida Bay. So it's just fresh water. And fresh water is okay. Gotcha. You know, we need fresh water. Really, this whole issue boils down to water.
Right.
You know, you can go 30 days without eating, 3 days without water, you're dead as a stone. Yep. And that's pretty much every animal.
When will the reservoir be completed? What's the estimated date?
I think about 5 years right now. So they're, you know, they're working on the first phase of it. We should see that complete in a couple of years, which is a smaller segment of it. And then I think the entire reservoir will be done in about 5 years, which is amazing. You know, it was a 20-year plan, and the plan actually has over 70 components to it. So there's more than just the reservoir. But the reservoir is the major one. It will alleviate probably, they estimate, between 60 and 70% of the releases.
Really?
That's so dramatic.
Wow. In 5 years.
In 5 years, yeah.
How many acres is that reservoir going to be?
Boy, that's a really good question. I believe it's 16,000 acres.
Okay.
Is a reservoir. God, I wish I had numbers on sugar. I'm believing that's... Sugar is 340,000 acres.
Wow.
So just to give you an idea of how big the EAA is.
Yeah, it's quite substantial.
Yeah, you know, it's always surprised me that, you know, there's this fight to stop that reservoir from happening. And the seems the main culprit is the sugar industry. And it's always sort of surprised me. They could say, we'll give you a mile of our land to cut a swath through, right, and build this reservoir and even, you know, make it larger. And we would build statues to those folks because it would clean our water. And it's so precious for us, clean our environment. And they're just fighting it the whole way. It's kind of crazy.
And are those fields privately owned?
They are. They're primarily owned by two companies, U.S. Sugar and I can't think of the name off the top of my head, but it's owned by two companies, which are basically, one is the Von Holes, which is an old company, a family that started in Cuba, raising sugar, and then came here and brought sugar here and you know, kind of instituted it. But it's a very select number of people who are benefiting from it. It's not that big of an industry. It's about a $300 million industry in Florida, you know, which, giving you an idea, I mean, fishing is probably a $12 million industry in Florida.
Right.
I mean, $12 billion, so I'm sorry.
Billion, right, with a B. Now, is that sugar being exported, or is it mainly for domestic use?
It's all consumed in the U.S.
It is. Okay.
Yeah. There's a tariff on sugar. You can't buy sugar. You can buy a limited supply on the world market. The world market is about 10 cents cheaper than you can buy in this country. There's a sort of the evil side of it, you know. You can buy sugar. Sugar prices are controlled in the United States. You can buy on the domestic market 15% of the amount that's bought in the country. And they have to be bought from the plantations owned by these two sugar companies.
Wow.
So they control 100% of the sugar sold in the United States.
Wow.
And because the prices are brought artificially high, we see more high fructose corn syrup used because it's cheaper. So, and we all know, you know, the obesity problems and health problems that are related to high fructose corn syrups. Well, creating high fructose corn syrups takes part of the corn supply. Corn's used to feed cattle. So now our beef prices go up, our ethanol prices go up, and we're fed a, you know, inferior product. Oh. When they could just open up the world market and you could buy sugar on the world market for a cheaper price. And not that it's healthier for you, you know, sugar's sugar.
Right.
It's not the best product for your body.
It's like anything in moderation is okay.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So, you know, if they opened up the world market, I mean, yeah, we'd drive the prices down, we would eat better, and, you know, probably all the sugar companies wouldn't even be there.
did those two companies control how many acres of land? I presume it's the state that needed the land for the reservoir, right?
The state needed the land, but they owned land. It was interesting because they owned land, and at times they leased the land to grow sugar. And in fact, the spot where the reservoir was leased to sugar. They were currently growing, and they still are currently growing sugar on that property.
Interesting.
And the lease ended in 2019.
Okay.
So we had a group who sort of controls the water, the South Florida Water Management District. They're all appointed by the governor. They were going to vote. They're the ones who vote on whether we renew the lease or not. And the new governor, Ron DeSantis, had come in, and he was wanting to review all this before making a decision. And they kind of last minute approved a lease, You know, despite congressmen asking them to not, despite the governor asking them to not. And they kind of forced the hand. So that got denied, let's say, you know, as being unconstitutional.
Sure.
All the people on the South Florida Water Management Board were replaced. It was, you know, they originally were people even in the sugar industry, but they were very pro-sugar, all of them. Mm. And now they're scientists or water managers. There's people who actually kind of care about the stuff and actually know about the stuff and how important it is to, you know, Dade County to have water, just water to drink. The lease got terminated. So now the reservoir is there. But it's always originally been state owned land.
I think it's important to also say, and if you don't mind, Captain Mike, if you can explain to the average boater that says, well, I don't boat in that area, I don't fish in that area, it's not important to me. Mm. And I think it's really important that not only is it important to boaters that might not fish or boat in that area, but it's important to every person that certainly lives in this country. And I hope that you can explain why that's really important.
That's very astute. It's people tend to look at things that take place in front of them and react to those, but not to things in other areas. This planet needs to be kept a certain way. It needs to be healthy for all generations. If you look at South Florida, there's very few people in this country who've never said, oh, I've never even thought of going to Florida. You know, sooner or later you want to visit Florida. And if Florida's not healthy, you're not going to want to come here. If it doesn't have the water that you want, if you can't go swimming, you're not going to come. If you know, we live in a very flat state. If you don't like golf, you better do something in the water or there's nothing to do here. So, but I think that's everywhere. I think you can look at the Chesapeake Bay. I think you can look at the pebble mines in Alaska. I think you can look around this country and you can almost use the term greed to the things that are destroyed in this country that, you know, just aren't right. They're done in the name of profit. They have long-term impacts on everybody. Okay. And, you know, if you look at our issue in Florida, well, you know, it's a federal issue. It has to be federally funded. So, you know, the people who vote on it are legislatures from every state. They're the ones who make the decisions on whether they support that. And, you know, we need people in every state in this country saying that needs to change. And it, you know, and same with the Chesapeake Bay, you know, same with San Francisco Bay. Everywhere you go, right, we're having these pollution issues. And if we destroy, you know, the stuff, the basis of our water, you know, where do we go next?
Right.
Then we have to find solutions to that. And it's always easier to not destroy it than to rebuild it.
Right. right? And I think it's important, and you touched on it, that just because someone might not live in the state of Florida, it's not to say it can't happen in their area. And it's really important to bring awareness.
It's everywhere. And you know, once a precedent is set, then the people who are doing it, they'll just go, well, we can do it here. Why can't we do it here?
Right.
And the next thing you know, you're going, how did that happen to us?
Right.
It's very common.
Do you know the total cost to rebuild it?
I do not. It's in the billions. And the plan, let's say the plan originally was estimated at $2 billion. Now it would be $5
billion. Interesting.
So the longer you delay it, the more it costs.
Yep.
I don't know the numbers off the top of my head.
Okay.
Right, so just so we're straight, I've only been with the organization about 7 months.
Okay. And what is your exact position?
I am the outreach and events manager for Captains.
Okay. And how many people make up Captains for Clean Water?
Right now, 16.
16. And it's all volunteer, correct?
No. It has paid positions as well.
It is. Okay. And this is not your full-time job, though, is it?
It's not my full-time job, though.
You are a captain.
I am a licensed charter captain, yeah.
Okay. So the people would ask, well, what can I do? So what can they do?
You know what is educate yourself. That's the biggest thing you can do. The biggest value you have is your voice. Go to captainsforcleanwater.org and you can get right on the site. It'll explain all the issues. We have videos you can watch. We have stuff you can read, but just educate yourself on it. Make your own decision. I think, you know, most people are pretty intelligent. With our issue with Everglades restoration, there's an answer. You know, we go after things that have a solution. There is a solution. It's an obvious solution. It just needs to be enacted, needs to be funded and happen. Everybody knows the answer. It just, you know, they've been delaying it. And that's part of Sugar's plan, is to delay it. Now it's starting to get done. And the louder you can speak as a voice, and the more you can contact your congressman. Join Captains if you'd like. Get on our mailing list if nothing else. We don't bomb people with emails. We send emails out when there's an opportunity to engage a representative or something really important coming up, in the government. But I would tell you that's 3 or 4 times a year. It's not very often. The more you want to get involved, the more we'd love to have you.
And people can volunteer, I presume?
They can. They can volunteer, they can sign up to volunteer, they can donate, they can give time. Really, the best thing you can do is get on our mailing list and educate yourself about the issue.
Okay. And I have to ask, because I don't think it would be right to not ask. There is a race around the state of Florida by boat. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Skiff Challenge. So that was really started by the marine industry. Sort of same deal. You know, in 2016 and 2018, we had major water issues in Florida. Major red tides, major cyanobacteria releases. So a lot of these marine manufacturers suffered because people weren't buying boats. And they can actually give you the hard numbers on, you know, they know how much they sell in Florida, and then they know how much they declined during those years.
Right.
They created this race from the Florida-Alabama state line all the way to Key West, then all the way back up the east coast of Florida to Jacksonville. You're doing it in an 18-foot skiff, 18-foot or less, 70-horsepower motor, nonstop. They run at night. They run in all weather conditions. They run it through thunderstorms, all of it. They two-man crew. Two-man support team. They cannot stop at marinas to gas up. They have to meet their crew and gas up in the water. They cannot pull their boat out of the water to do repairs. If your boat falls apart, it falls apart. And it's interesting. It's interesting. We video it the whole way. We have trackers where you can follow the different crews. You can get on and support the crews. It's pretty interesting.
And when is that race?
It starts April 8th runs through the 12th. Between the 11th and 12th, it depends on how long it takes them. Right. You know, most of them are there very early on the 12th. But we have people who come 20 hours later.
It's crazy. It's intense. Now, is the hope for that race a fundraiser for Captains for Clean Water?
Not really. It's really just to draw attention to Everglades Restoration and Captains for Clean Water.
Okay.
And is that support the mission?
Understood. And is it open to any manufacturer of a skiff that's 18 or under?
Been open to anyone.
It is.
And we typically get 5 to 8 entrants.
Because nobody's that adventurous, I presume?
It's grueling. It really is. We've talked several times about maybe, you know, having stops where they don't run at night just because of safety issues. And the guys, I mean, you know, by the time they get to Key West, the teams aren't talking to each other. They yell at each other constantly. That's how they communicate. I mean, they're ground down, and the sleep deprivation catches up on them. And when you see them, they look like they've been through the ringer.
Yeah. They kind of have in a way.
It's pretty funny. It really is. Some of the things that happen are pretty funny.
Can people volunteer for that portion of the fun?
Well, so there's really not much you can do volunteer-wise.
Okay.
For the event. They leave from the Floribama bar. They leave from right in front of there. And then sometimes they don't touch land. They stop. They have a mandatory stop in Largo, Florida, right at the base of Keys.
Okay.
They stop there for immediate stop. They have a mandatory, I think it's an hour media stop. Then they have to go to Key West. The southernmost point, Key West, they have to take a picture of themselves. They're on the southernmost point. So they got to pull the boat up on the beach, run up there, take a picture, get back in the boat. And then they come up the East Coast. And the difference, you know, the Gulf of Mexico is pretty calm.
Right.
A lot of times. So you may get a nice run, but the Atlantic's not so kind.
Yeah.
And, you know, they get 6 and 8 foot seas. They get some really, really bad stuff that they run through.
Captain Mike, is there anything that I haven't asked that you feel would be really important to share with the listeners about Captains for Clean Water?
You know, not really. I mean, just keep in mind that we're an advocacy group. We're out there just trying to gain momentum, to draw attention to Everglades restoration. It's so important for Florida and for Florida's ecosystem. And given the worsening of events that we've had over the last, 6, 8, 10 years, it's gotten worse and worse and worse and worse. It's really, really ramping up. A lot of us that live in Florida are just scared. You know, if you live on the coast, you're impacted. If you live on the coast from, you know, State Road 60, which is just above Lake Okeechobee, from there down, so from Vero Beach on the East Coast and Tampa on the West Coast, from there down, you know, it's impacted by these discharges. It's impacted by the dirty waters being pumped out and the cyanobacteria that's coming out to our coast. Okeechobee's a mess right now.
Yeah.
It's a major, you know, I think it's the second largest lake in this country.
Yep.
And it has some issues. It has some health issues. And same deal. We're concerned about that. We want Lake Okeechobee to always be there and to be this beautiful lake that everybody comes down to bass fish and to recreate on. So if we don't make some changes, it's going to go bad. And then, you know, there's a reason everybody lives on the coast. Right. Over 60% of this country lives on the coast because we love the water. Right. We love being around it. It's calming. It recharges our souls. You know, if you don't fight for it, it'll be gone and you'll be one going, man, I wish I would have said something.
Will Captains for Clean Water also advocate for other bodies of water?
We will.
Okay.
We see us as expanding.
Okay, great.
You know, we're not going away once Everglades restoration's been solved and been taken care of. There's plenty of issues out there.
Okay.
The ones we'll choose will be ones that have solutions. You know, there's a bunch out there that they haven't even figured out what to do yet.
Right.
You got to have a plan and a way to heal those things. And once you have a way to heal, you know, then it's just about getting state and federal support.
Right. Are you willing or able to talk about the other bodies of water that you guys might address?
So I don't know enough about them. I mean, we support, a lot of times we'll stand and support like the pebble mine issue up in Alaska.
Okay.
You know, there's already a group advocating there. We just will stand in support of that group because they're the authority on their issue.
Understood.
And as these issues grow, though, I just see we're going to have to grow in size and take them on, sadly. Yeah. It's sad. It's just happened across the country.
Well, Mike, it's a great cause. It really is wonderful. I hope people will go to captainsforcleanwater.org, read about it, educate yourself a little bit. Hopefully this video has helped you. Keep in mind, all the water is all we have, right? And it's really important to keep it not only as clean as we can keep it, but also around for others. And please, if you're a boater or a swimmer and you see trash in the water, pick it up.
Even if that's a good point too, if you pick up one piece of trash a day, you can make a difference. One piece.
Absolutely. Please. Balloons. Do not release balloons in honor of somebody. It actually hurts the environment.
We see those a lot in the ocean.
Because they go in the water. Remember, we're 70%. This land is 70% water, right? I believe that is correct.
That's correct.
So it's really important. Pick up trash. Don't put trash in there. Pick up, and take care of it. It's all we have. Thank you so much, Mike. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. The pleasure's mine.
Very good. That went well. Hopefully.